From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, working with young people accused of robbery, drug dealing, prostitution, and murder. Mary Previty makes a return visit to Fresh Air to tell us more about how she turned a dirty, foul-smelling youth detention center into one that became a national model for juvenile corrections. And we pay tribute to two jazz musicians who died a few days ago, trumpeter Red Rodney and guitarist Sonny Chirac. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal grand jury has indicted Congressman Dan Rostenkowski on 17 felony counts. The jury alleges he stole more than $500,000 from the government over 20 years and then tried to obstruct the investigation of his office. The charges were painstakingly detailed at a news conference this afternoon by U.S. Attorney Eric Holder.
According to the indictment, Congressman Rostenkowski engaged in a pattern of corrupt activity for more than 20 years and embezzled hundreds of thousands of taxpayers' dollars from his congressional expense allowances in order to enrich himself, his family, and his friends. Today's indictment represents a dramatic step forward in the investigation into criminal activity at the United States House of Postal, United States Representatives Post Office.
Holder charges that Rostenkowski padded his official payroll with workers who performed few or no official duties, used his office account to buy expensive gifts, and used government-leased cars for personal business. Holder also alleged some people on the congressman's payroll were required to give some of the money back to the lawmaker's Chicago office. Rostenkowski has declared his innocence and predicts that he will be vindicated at trial. Democratic Senator Sam Nunn says the United States has to rethink its policy on Haiti. The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee says returning toppled President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide to power won't necessarily restore Haitian democracy. He told NBC today the U.S. should work on easing the suffering of Haitian people and preventing a mass flood of refugees to America. The private conference board says Americans have lost some of their confidence in the economy. Steve Beckner of Market News Service has this report.
After rising steeply in March and April, the conference board's closely watched index of consumer confidence fell 4.5 points in May to 87.6. That compares to 61.9 a year ago. The conference board, a business-funded research group, surveys 5,000 households on how they feel about current employment opportunities and business conditions and also asks for their future economic assessments. For whatever reasons, consumers expressed less confidence about how things look now than about the future. Poll respondents were much less positive about current job prospects and business conditions than they had been in April, but they were only moderately more pessimistic in their expectations of what the economy will be like 6 months from now. The conference board's Fabian Linden said consumer confidence is still at a fairly reassuring level. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
The government says sales of new homes dropped 6.8% in April, the first drop in 3 months. Sales were down in all regions except the Midwest, which rang up double-digit gains. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 3 points at 3,760. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. United Nations officials have suspended all their operations in Kigali, Rwanda. A peacekeeper was killed there today when a mortar shell blew up near his car. Mark Doyle reports for the BBC.
A senior UN officer said the death of an estimated 500,000 people in Rwanda was a terrible statistic, and the death of the single Senegalese officer was a tragedy. The late Captain Jan's Senegalese companions asked that his story be told. Among the first Rwandan lives that Captain Jan saved were the children of a politician who was murdered by government soldiers shortly after the war began. Captain Bai Jan then rescued numerous locally employed Rwandan UN staff when the official policy of the United Nations was to save expatriate employees first. He ran a gauntlet of government militia intent on murder to save numerous families. At one stage, Captain Jan hid 5 children in his own room for several days before taking them away to safety.
Mark Doyle reporting. Members of the Nassau County Commission say they're going to examine yesterday's drowning of five holiday swimmers on a Florida beach. They were drowned by dangerous riptides. No lifeguards were on duty. Six other swimmers were dragged under but managed to escape. One woman is hospitalized in serious condition. Another man is in stable condition. Nassau County Chairman John Crawford says lifeguards at all county beaches were dropped 4 years ago to save about $100,000 every year. Hundreds of Los Angeles police officers are staging a wildcat sick-out today. The city and the police union are still bickering over a new contract. 226 of the 494 uniformed officers supposed to work yesterday called in sick. Day shift officers were kept on overtime to fill in. The absences could cost Los Angeles more than $1 million a day. The police union says it is not coordinating the action. A judge has issued a restraining order that blocks the union from leading walkouts. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most violent children today, the young people that frighten and baffle us and seem most beyond reach, are the young people that Mary Previty tries to help, the children accused of dealing drugs, prostitution, robbery, and murder. Previty is the administrator of the Camden County Youth Center, a New Jersey detention center where young people accused of crimes are held as they await trial. She spoke with us last year about her work. We invited her back to tell us more. Previty has written a new book called Hungry Ghosts that tells how she turned the center around from a filthy, foul-smelling hideaway for misfits and discards to a national model in juvenile corrections. She wants the center to be a safe haven where young people can focus on education, self-improvement, and hope. The first weekend Previty took over the center in 1974, she had a riot on her hands.
When I arrived on the second floor, the boys were locked down. They were behind steel doors. They were doing a clanging, banging, just like bringing the roof down with the noise. That was what I came on. And, of course, my officers are standing by. I'm a brand new political appointee, a suburban housewife homemaker, and here I am walking onto the floor. I know you won't believe this, Terry, in a hostess dress. I had been giving a dinner party, crystal and china and candlelight at my home when they called and said there's a riot. So I come out onto this floor, and my officers are standing by watching, because nobody believed that I was going to last in that place.
This was your big test.
There was no question. I mean, here they're standing by. These are people that had been punched in the face, kicked. There had been violence against the staff. There had been violence against kids. It went both ways. So they knew how dangerous these youth were. I mean, these are teenage boys charged, many of them, with felonies. I had not a clue what to do. The only thing that I knew what to do was to get up to the first youngster that I had begun to develop a relationship with, and I went to his door. His name was Stevie. And I lowered my voice really softly and began to talk with him. And I said, Stevie, what is this about? Well, you could just hear the noise level go down the hallway because everyone wanted to know whether Stevie was going to be a rat. So this lady standing there whispering or talking really softly at one door through the grate into his bedroom, everyone down the hall softened down the clanging. And noise is one of the biggest trippers of riots. Just that awful noise. It does something to your head. It does something to your fists. It just like it sets you up for war.
So what did he say when you said, what is this
well,
about?
Well, it was... He just, something about recreation or something, and I thought, well, you know, you could fix something like that. There were ways of fixing no recreation or not enough fresh air or something. That was something you could fix. But it really, it was sort of a listening gently to kids as to what was it about inside them that triggered this type of rage.
How else did the kids test you that evening?
Well, really, that was really it. It was like a test to see if I was part of the thems. The thems were officers that had been involved with brute force against youngsters, the business of mace, Mace was regularly used. It was kept immediately available in a locked cabinet there on the floor. And there were officers that would even boast that they just knew the way. You could get a kid fixed down real quick. You just put some type of a blanket over his door. You'd spray the mace across his radiator in his room and lock him in, and you could keep a kid choking and gagging for an entire 8-hour shift and have him out of your hair.
Mary Previty, you are not a physically imposing presence. You're about 5'4", about 125 pounds. You live in the suburbs. You're not the kind of person who's going to show muscle, and people will feel so intimidated by you that they'll behave. When you showed up that night, during the riot, kids started asking you questions like, how much did that dress cost?
Absolutely.
Were you drinking? What kind of food were you serving? And now, when I read this in your book, I was thinking, well, if this happened to me, I wouldn't know how to interpret it. Because I'd figure they were testing me, but I wouldn't know, like, what they were looking for in my response. Were they seeing if they could ask me questions that were too personal, that I shouldn't be responding to, like what my dress cost or what I was doing at home that night? Or should I just respond and just be really open with them,
Well, that was my feeling.
Uh-huh.
The need to be open. I felt that I needed to show myself as an ordinary human being, because when you put violence and force out as your weapon, guaranteed violence and force is what you will get back. I could never win on that playing ground.
As you say in your book, there's a lot of detention officers, correction officers, who work by the creed that if you treat people with kindness, they will see your kindness as weakness, and they will take advantage of what they perceive as your weakness. They'll take advantage of your kindness.
I don't think that's what you're describing is true. I disagree with it, and I don't operate my youth center from that. I have personally observed over 20 years that the officers that are most successful in connecting with young men and young women are the ones who come across as human beings that demonstrate that they really care, they're interested, they're absolutely delighted with the youth. That's the kind of person that develops a relationship. I don't mean relationship in a you owe me type of thing, but that this person genuinely enjoys young people, absolutely delighted in their silly stories or their silly rivalries, and you can laugh over something that they do. That's the kind of person that almost never gets the challenge of a fist or a foot or spitting or something awful. That's the kind of officer that usually can calm a scene when there's difficulty brewing.
So you took over the center at a time of riots. What were the first changes you made?
Well, I'll tell you this. The freeholder who appointed me and I chipped in together and bought a St. Bernard puppy. The kids named him Mr. Tim. Everybody had to be Miss So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so. So the boys called the dog Mr. Tim. We began painting the colors more like a teenage type of place with bright looking colors. We began to bring in huge numbers of volunteers that would do a variety of things. Maybe they would have artwork with the youngsters or arts and crafts, or we brought in music therapists from Hahnemann Medical School, interns, college interns to do things with the youngsters. But one of the biggest things we said, school was going to be the most important part of our day. Children would learn, they would like to go to school. So we began getting federal grants to emphasize the school, and it wasn't very much longer after that where we began to have kids wanting to go to school. Kids would want to go to the after-school volunteer tutoring period. And it wasn't that long till we were awarded Outstanding Education Program in the nation for juvenile corrections, because the kids were learning, jumping by leaps and bounds, because teachers cared about them.
So you wanted to create an environment that was safe, that was appropriate for the teenagers and kids who were there, that had some kind of cheerfulness about it, even though it was a detention center.
And small and intimate, because kids need to feel like everything right there is to help them to grow.
You wanted to be encouraging. At the same time, you knew the potential for danger and, as you say, savagery, because you witnessed it that first weekend during the riot. So what did you do to let the kids know that although you were there to encourage them and help them and make the place as kind of welcoming as possible, that at the same time, if they got out of line, you weren't going to stand for it?
Well, let me tell you, we make safety number one. That has got to be safe for children, safe for staff. My people need to go home knowing that they will go home to a wife or husband or children when they leave the shift. I have got to guarantee that safety to them. And children who come in, the first message that they have to be given is, I am going to keep you safe here, and I will see that nobody hurts you. And you may not hurt somebody else. I will see to it that you do not hurt anybody else.
You tell the kids that if they hurt one of your officers,
I will hurt you.
Or the building.
I will hurt you.
What will you do to hurt them?
Well, I will, in fact, sometimes if someone has just done something, I will demonstrate it. I will call all the boys together, and I start with a positive, and I say, how many of you know about the good letters I send to the judge? Oh, then their hands go up, and they wave, and they get all excited, and some of them maybe not have heard about this. Say, when people act good here, and they positively take part in our program and go to school and learn their success skills, I write a letter to the judge and send a copy to your father and mother. I said, how many of you think that this same hand that types the letter to the judge about being good can type a letter that says you've been bad? Oh, now all of a sudden you get quivering on the bench and all the eyes are looking at me. And I say to them, I tell you, if you hurt my staff or if you hurt my building, I will hurt you. We have got to teach children the consequences of behavior, because a lot of them think that nothing ever happens to them. And the structure and the rules, let me tell you something, that has been the hallmark of our program. Giving children freedom does not save them. It damns them almost guaranteed forever. But you give a kid rules, you give a kid expectations, and you give them a pat on the back, you remind them what it is you're going to do to help them be successful, you've got a different human being that you're dealing with.
My guest is Mary Preverty. She runs the Camden County Youth Center, a detention center in New Jersey. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Preverty. She's written a memoir called Hungry Ghosts. You've lost a lot of kids from the center who've been murdered.
True.
Is there any kind of ritual that you go through at the center when one of your people has been killed?
No. We've never made a ritual just like that. Once in a while, I've gone in with the clippings or have sat down with the kids and talked about them. Do you know what the attitude usually is?
What?
They bought it. You know, I can remember a youngster that written, I had had so many stories written by this child in the student newspaper, and he was going to go straight. He had decided he was going to get a job and not sell drugs anymore. 2-3 years later, here's the story in the newspaper. I said, no, it cannot, this isn't, it can't be. Not Jamel. Cannot be. Got to the youth center, pulled out the files to see, was that his name? It was. And I go back to the kids, and I thought, well, now, I printed the stories that he wrote in the paper, how he was going to give up drugs and how he was changing his ways. And then on the back of the page was the clipping of his being killed. And they all said to me, he was one of the big boys. Big boy means he was one of the main drug dealers. And he was shot down at like 5 o'clock in the morning by somebody that was going to come to get his money.
What are the funerals like now for young people who are killed? And what are some of the rituals, if any, that surround them?
I was astonished. I went to one of my youngsters. I went to one of the funerals. And the boys fill my head with and massive stories of big cars and gaudy gold and clothes. And so I pulled up at the church thinking there were going to be all these Mercedes and fancy cars. They were broken down jalopies. One car had a flat tire. There, all these people were down on their knees fixing the flat tires so they could quickly get from the church in the church professional in this car limping along to get to the funeral, the actual burial ground. I get there, and the children all have T-shirts custom painted at the Pennsauken Mart. And they go there, and whoever it is that paints them with spray paint, it was Dayglow Tombstones, it was in memory of, and like a rainbow over the tombstone, and all this in memory of, and then the boy's name there, and all these, we love you, all spray painted. And then all these children wearing white gloves carrying the casket walking toward the hole in the ground. And I just stood there watching, and then they all had a flower put in their hands. And the brother, who's a child we'd also had, was like the big brother. He goes over there, stands right next to his knees up against the coffin, and he does like a high five up in the air, just as though he was high-fiving his brother, and all he clutches is empty air, and he just collapsed down and started weeping on the grave. I couldn't stand it. I said, a teenager dead. And how many of the children burying him will be dead next week, next month?
So it sounds almost as if there's this whole sense of ritual that's developed around the funerals, the spray painting of the T-shirts.
There absolutely is. And then the back of all their cars, they have shoe polish white across all of the back of the back windows of the cars that say, in memory of. And as soon as they leave the cemetery, I didn't wait for it, they go out looking for who killed them. It's like dispatched from the graveyard to drive around town to find out who did it.
Wow, so the next step after...
Yes, is the payback.
You are from such an incredibly different world than the world that you work in now. I mean, you are the child of missionary parents. You grew up in China, where your parents were Methodist missionaries. You went to... a kind of fine and very strict school for the children of missionaries. Then, as we'll get to in a second, you spent several years in a Japanese concentration camp. But I'm wondering, you know, are you shocked by what you see? I think a lot of, I don't know what the kids know about your background, but if they didn't know who you are now, they might think she is just going to fall to pieces when she knows the kind of background we're from. Is just going to shock her. She won't be able to deal with it. I guess I'm trying to figure out how you could come from this missionary background.
But I also come...
Strict background.
I come from a very tough world. You know, my parents had certainly seen other kinds of horror, poverty and foot binding in China, starvation and the tragedies of war. So I certainly have not come from a cream puff world. It's a different kind of violence that I find here, different kind of tragedy from what I had grown up in. But I certainly was not protected from horror and tragedy having lived through a war in China.
Do you tell the young people at the detention center about your experiences in the concentration camp?
Sometimes I do. They're absolutely fascinated.
What do you tell them about it?
Well, the whole story. Sometimes we'll sit down in a whole group and I'll tell them the whole story and they will just be fascinated. I was sort of a born storyteller, so I love to go and tell them stories. And often they're stories about me.
One of the stories I bet the young people really want to hear about you has to do with how you lost your hand.
That will shut them down to complete quiet. I tell them how I lost my hand in an accident, and all of a sudden it's like, I broke a code. You don't talk about somebody has one hand or something that makes them quite different. So when I open the door, it's just mass quiet. And this is how I'll tell the story.
Wait, let me stop.
Go
before
ahead.
You do, I just want to say you are wearing a short sleeve red and white polka dot dress today. And your arm is severed a little above the wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not wearing a prosthetic device to cover up the fact that you're missing a hand. It's you know, if you look at you in a short sleeve dress, it's obvious.
Very obvious.
Right. So for a young person who's meeting you for the first time, they're going to notice that.
Sure.
So, and as you said, they're not going to ask about it because you don't do that. So how do you bring it up?
Well, sometimes I'll bring it up. I tell this story for a couple of different lessons, so I may tell it in a different way each time. Some kid will say, so-and-so just got sentenced, and he was so nice, and he was only 14. And I'll say, let me tell you a story. I said, I was so nice, and I was only 14, and I one time bumped my hand upon a revolving saw. And now look how old I am. And I'm carrying a mistake that I made when I was only 14. Sometimes saying you're sorry does not make the mistake go away. So you have to be careful what you do, that making a mistake, even when you're so young as 14, can leave you marked for the rest of your life.
Now, you're marked for the rest of your life. You're missing your mm-hmm. hand, but you haven't let that stand in the way.
Well, I tell the story a different way. I say, you know what my daddy said to me? They love daddy stories. Most of them don't have daddies. So they just want to soak up any daddy story. I'll say, you know what my daddy was braiding my pigtails after I lost my hand and I was 14. And he said, Mary, sweetheart, do you know what your brother Bertie said to you when you lost your hand and he heard about it? And I was really curious what my little brother said, because I think he was eyeing my bicycle. And my brother, he said, now Mary can't ride her bicycle. And he said, Mary, sweetheart, you know what I said? I said, well, I don't know why not. And I say to the kids, it's like my daddy's words were written across the sky of my entire life. He didn't think there was anything I couldn't do. So that kind of a message that I can build into the same story, I don't know why not.
The kind of work that you're in, there's such a high burnout level there. And there's even a high burnout level for teachers in schools in which there's a lot of crime. And you just get emotionally exhausted by it, I think, after a while. And a lot of people, understandably, leave after a few years. You've been at this for 20 years. You know there's no instant solutions. You're not kidding yourself about how you're, like, working complete magic and everybody walks out of your center is saved. What keeps you going in spite of all the obstacles and all the losses?
The little gifts. I get so many little gifts every day, and I look for the short term and the little, because I can never expect the long term. And when a girl that has been in crisis and just so hurting will put her arm around me, will ask me to sit down next to her at the table, or a boy that I have just been working with a lot, or he and I have written a story for our student newspaper together, and I'm walking down the hallway, and Danny will reach across the hallway and pat my arm. I go home like knowing every day that I get so much more than what I give. I get so high from those little touches that you know you've connected with a youngster in a very private way. I have never been burned out.
So that's what keeps you going. You look for the little things.
Yeah.
So that way you're not, you don't let yourself be disappointed when the big magical things don't happen.
I never look for them.
Mary Previty, thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry.
Mary Previty runs the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. Her new memoir, Hungry Ghosts, is published by Zondervan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the jazz world lost two very talented, very different kinds of musicians in the past few days, trumpeter Red Rodney and guitarist Sonny Chirac. Rodney is best known for his work as a sideman with Charlie Parker. Chirac brought the innovations of free jazz to the guitar. We'll remember each of them with excerpts of their Fresh Air interviews. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A blue flu epidemic has hit the Los Angeles Police Department. It began last night when nearly half the officers scheduled to work failed to show up for their shifts. This is the latest episode in the police union's two-year fight with the city over a new contract. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Police department officials are keeping the officers that do show up for work on overtime, so the police force remains at its usual strength. But the bill for those extra hours could reach $1 million a day. The Police Protective League, the rank-and-file officers' union, is not sponsoring the sick-out. It's been forbidden to do so by court order. Instead, word of the job action was circulated on an unsigned memo, which says the officers are scheduled to recover from the blue flu on Wednesday. But there may be a relapse in late June when the first game of the World Cup soccer tournament will be played at the Rose Bowl. While the sick-out was in progress, negotiators for the police union and the city were trying to hammer out a new contract. Union membership recently voted down an offer of a 6% raise over 2 years. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The man at the center of the White House helicopter controversy has changed his mind. David Watkins now says he'll pay what it cost to fly him on a golf outing. He took a presidential helicopter. The cost of using that copter and a second one that flew along with it was more than $13,000. Watkins was forced out last week when the trip came to light. He still insists he did nothing wrong, but he says he changed his mind about paying for the flights after other senior White House aides said they'd cover the cost. He says he didn't want the financial burden to fall on them. Watkins is a millionaire from Arkansas. Three organized crime families have been implicated in a plot to skim profits from Louisiana's video poker industry. Jim Engster reports.
17 people have been arrested in the investigation. Louisiana State Police Captain Ronnie Jones says the Genovese and Gambino families of New York and the Marcello family of New Orleans are involved. Among those arrested, Joseph Paul Marcello Jr.
Joseph Marcello is the brother of the late Carlos Marcello, and it's obvious that organized crime continues to operate in Louisiana, and we've got to be as vigilant as ever to prevent them from getting involved in gambling.
The crime figures allegedly infiltrated worldwide gaming of Louisiana and Louisiana route operators in an alleged scheme to skim profits from machines produced by Bally Incorporated. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Engster in Baton Rouge.
The government says Americans' personal income rose a moderate 0.4% in April, but their spending fell 0.1%. The Commerce Department says consumer spending is down for only the second time in 13 months. Spending makes up 2/3 of the nation's economic activity. Stock prices were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials added a point to end the day at 3,758. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin says peace talks between Israel and Syria are moving slowly. Israel Radio says Rabin told Parliament today there's no point in Secretary of State Warren Christopher returning to the Mideast. He was supposed to come back in a couple of weeks. The talks are stuck over the possible Israeli pullout from the Golan Heights. Syria wants a complete pullout. Israel says the extent of the withdrawal will depend on the result of peace talks. Sales of new homes fell 6.8% in April, partly as a result of rising interest rates from mortgages. NPR's John Itzty reports.
If the pace of new home sales in April continued for 12 months, 683,000 new homes would be sold in the United States over the year-long period. That's down from the 733,000 annual rate in March. Bad weather in February, which caused a bulge of sales in March that couldn't be sustained, contributed to the April slowdown. Higher mortgage rates also contributed. In April, mortgage rates averaged 8.32%, up more than half a point from March. And rates climbed even higher during May. The higher rates have priced some buyers out of the market. As a result, the National Association of Home Builders has lowered its forecast of home sales for 1994 by about 50,000 units. Regionally, home sales plunged in the Northeast and in the South in April, while they were moderately lower in the West. In the Midwest, sales shot up. I'm John Idstein in Washington.
President Clinton leaves for Europe tomorrow. He's going to lead the U.S. delegation to the 50th anniversary observance of the D-Day invasion. His trip will last 8 days. The final ceremony will be in Normandy, France. The president has been preparing for the trip for several weeks. He's met with historians and spoken with World War II veterans who fought in key battles. The president delivered 2 speeches yesterday honoring the valor of World War II vets. He called on parents to teach their children about the last World War. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The jazz world lost 2 very talented, very different musicians late last week, trumpeter Red Rodney and guitarist Sonny Chirac. We're going to remember each of them with excerpts of their Fresh Air interviews. Red Rodney went on the road when he was still a teenager and played in the bands of Claude Thornhill, Gene Krupa, and Woody Herman. In 1949, he ended up in the place just about every young jazz musician wanted to be, Charlie Parker's band. Parker hired him to replace Miles Davis. After Rodney left the band, his jazz career floundered, in part because of his drug habit. But he made a comeback in the 70s and kept recording and performing around the world. He died Friday of lung cancer at his home in Boynton Beach, Florida. He was 66. I spoke with Red Rodney in June of 1990. Now, you started off playing in big bands. How did you first hear Bob and start playing it yourself?
Well, I had already been with a lot of the named bands because the war was on and all of the good trumpet players were drafted. And I was working in the house band of Atlantic City Steel Pier when all those bands came in, minus 1 or 2 trumpets. So they needed people like me. And I remember Dizzy took me up to New York one Sunday, sat me in the middle of the Three Deuces and to hear his band, and I heard Charlie Parker. It was like a religious experience. I was completely overwhelmed. I remember leaving that place 4 o'clock in the morning and walking around like I didn't know what to do, where to go, how to think, but I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That's how powerful that affected me.
Well, Charlie Parker eventually hired you to replace Miles Davis. Did you feel prepared for that?
Not really. No, I told him, too. I told him I really wasn't ready for that. And he said, well, let me be the judge of that. He said, I know a good trumpet player when I hear one, and I think you are ready and you'll be more ready once you come. And, of course, I grabbed it. I often say that was like going to college and graduate school, the 3.5 years I played with him.
Did Parker take you under his wing in addition to taking you into his band?
Well, I don't know about that. We were very friendly even before that. And, of course, we became more friendly when I was working for him. I was thrilled that a man like that could like me. I don't think I liked myself very much, but I was really thrilled that he did. And I guess you might say he took me under his wing a little bit, yeah. of course, when he saw that I was trying to emulate him, he protested violently.
Emulate him in which way?
Well, in his drug use. And, he got very, very upset, and of course he didn't like it at all.
Did you start using heroin as a way to emulate him? Is that what it was about?
Yes, I was very immature, and I kept looking and looking and saying, oh my God, if I cross that line, could I possibly play like that? Curiosity killed the cat, you know, and pretty soon you wind up with a little habit. You don't play any better. In fact, you don't really live up to your potential because you have to be healthy to play well. And there it is. It took me years to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. One of the celebrated stories in jazz lore is a story that was also recounted in the movie Bird. And that's the story of how during one of your tours through the South with Charlie Parker, he knew that an integrated band wouldn't go over well in the segregated South, that there were places you wouldn't be allowed to play. So he had the band advertised as Charlie Parker with albino red. So you were passed off as a black albino. This is a true story, right?
Yes, it is. We didn't fool anybody.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was very nice. And he had me sing a blues, and like the kid in the movie did. I think I sang better than that, though.
So. Is the story true that you ended up moving to a white hotel and Parker said, I'll come with you, you could call me your valet?
Yeah, and they didn't show that in the movie. They should have, because that was hilarious. It would have been much better than the story they put in there in a hotel where he asked me to kick him in his rear end, and that never happened.
So tell me the valet story.
Well, after about a week or 10 days, we were in Atlanta, and I saw this big, beautiful hotel, and I said, you know, I'm going to go check in there. I'm going to take a bath. I'm sorry, but I'm doing this. He says, that's a good idea, and I can go with you as your valet. And I thought he was crazy, but he knew the South. If any white man at that time would register and say, John Jones and valet, they would not question it, and they'd give the valet a room along with him. And that's what happened. I remember him trying to send me downstairs to get cigarettes and newspaper. I said, no, you got to go down. You're the valet.
Let me play something that you recorded with Parker. Let's hear Parker's composition, Blues for Alice. And would you like to say anything about your memories of this recording session?
Well, that particular session, I was playing in the Jewish Alps, the Catskill Mountains. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call. Well, I'm in the swimming pool, and he said, you better get down here quickly. Norman Granz is doing a record date with us, and told me the studio, and I said, I'll be right down. Well, it took three, four hours to get there. But I made it, and that was it. That was the Blues for Alice Swedish Schnapps date. I think it's called Swedish Schnapps, the album. At least originally it was.
Uh-huh. So this is Charlie Parker with Red Rodney on trumpet, John Lewis at the piano, Ray Brown on bass, Kenny Clark drums.
Trumpeter Red Rodney died on Friday. We'll hear more of our 1990 interview with Rodney after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with more of our interview with the late trumpeter Red Rodney.
You spent a good part of the 1960s in showbiz, playing in Vegas bands. Why did you end up leaving jazz and going to Vegas?
Well, I had children. I was straightening my life out. Mm-hmm. And I, Vegas, you made a good living. You played in the hotel showroom orchestras. You worked 3 hours a day and you made $600-$800 a week, which is a very good salary. Especially for then. The only unfortunate thing is there's no jazz at all. It was strictly showbiz. And eventually my jazz roots had to catch up to me. When my kids grew and left and went out on their own, I came right back to New York and came right back into jazz. And I've been very happy ever since.
What kind of shows did you play for in Vegas?
Well, I worked in the Flamingo for many years, and then the Hilton. I played Frank Sinatra. I played Tom Jones. I played so many. A lot of the big-name stars. I played French Reviews at another hotel there. And all things that you really don't like doing. But the living out there is very good if you're not a gambler. Living in the desert was beautiful. It's a nice place to retire to, really. It's very inexpensive. The taxes are very low. However, there's no jazz. And there probably never will be when, you know, the people that go there for the gambling and a big extravaganza, the Hollywood-type shows, these people listen to music with their feet instead of their ears.
When you decided to go back to New York and get back into jazz, how did you start?
I went with George Wein. He called me, and it was 1974. And took me to Europe on a tribute to Charlie Parker, the musical life of Charlie Parker. I did that tour. When that tour was finished, I stayed there and lived in Copenhagen for about almost 2 years. I lived in Copenhagen, but I worked all over Europe, and that got me back into the jazz market. And living in Copenhagen was very nice, and of course there's lots of work in Europe for an American jazz musician of some standing. However, I no longer had to be away from America, and I missed it terribly. I really wanted to come back. This is my home, and I love it. So I just picked up and came home.
Was it hard for you to start playing jazz again? I mean, did you have to get back in the swing of things?
You have to get back a little bit, sure. You just can't pick up your horn and start doing it. That period in Europe was very good for me because I was working quite a bit. I was getting all my thoughts together. And when I got back to America, I was in good shape. I was better than I had ever been. In fact, my best years musically have been between the ages of 50 and 62. You know, after I straightened my life out, the jazz profession is very, very forgiving. As long as you can play, and as long as they see that you're okay, you're welcomed back like nothing ever happened. So I've been very lucky. And I would hope that the other people who straighten up become as lucky as I did.
Red Rodney died of lung cancer on Friday at the age of 66. We'll remember guitarist Sonny Chirac after this break. This is Fresh Air. Dan Rostenkowski was indicted today. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Well, we are spending some time on this one, Terry. Nina Totenberg will discuss the 17-count indictment and talk about exactly what's involved there. And Elizabeth Arnold will talk about Dan Rostenkowski's career in Congress and what he has meant as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee and what his absence may mean. We will also be talking to a Chicago journalist who will tell us how the folks out home, back home are taking the news. Also, the last of our Africa series is on today. This is about a women's bank in Ghana. We have a commentary from Joyce Maynard on her child, who is the third in line for hand-me-downs.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During the free jazz movement of the 1960s, saxophonists left behind melody and chord changes for the unstructured abandon of shrieking, squawking solos. Sonny Chirac was the first free jazz guitarist. He used volume and electronic distortion to get the feeling saxophonists got from overblowing. Chirac's power playing later won him a following in the art rock world and in heavy metal music. Sonny Chirac died of a heart attack on Thursday at his home in Ossining, New York. He was 53. I spoke with him in 1991. Described yourself as a guitarist who always thought he was a horn player. Why did you play guitar instead of saxophone?
Oh, I had asthma as a child, and that plus the expense of a saxophone. When I started playing, the guys I wanted to play with, they had a guitar around, so they said, well, play this. And I picked it up and tried to play it.
Now, what did you want the guitar to do that you heard the saxophone do?
Sound like Coltrane. That's what I wanted. That sound that the saxophone players, well, not just saxophone players, like Miles, too, that what used to be called the cry of jazz, that's what I was after, and I'd never heard that done on a guitar, and that's what I wanted to reach.
Let me play your solo on Promises Kept. Can you tell us a little bit what you're doing on this?
I don't know, because it was a one-time thing. I think we recorded it in one take. And which is the way I like to record, so I don't remember at all what I did. I just played what I felt.
So you don't have any gizmos or anything attached to your guitar?
Nothing at all. I do on stage. I use a wireless system because it gives me mobility and I can get around the stage. I like being all over the stage, but that's the only thing I use besides the volume knob. That's you know.
And how do you work the volume?
Well,
knob?
I usually use a Marshall amplifier, which is kind of strange for so-called jazz player, but I turn it up to really usually no more than about 4 out of 10. I turn it up to a 4 and turn the guitar all the way up, the volume knob, and just play. I really believe your sound is in your hands. You know, I've always believed that. Like horn players believe that their sound is in theirs, you know. The standard approach to learning how to play jazz is to listen to your favorite player and copy their licks and then develop your own out of that. And I was starting at 20 years old, and I realized I didn't have time to go through that very long route. I figured that would take 10 years to work yourself out of that, to find yourself. So I just started right out playing what I heard in my head. And at that time, it was very little, but you know, that's the way I did it. I never played anyone's licks. I think I do know one Coltrane lick that he was very fond of playing on ballads. And sometimes I do that just for fun. But I never played anyone else's riffs, no.
You say you're still not fond of the guitar?
No, I don't like it. It's not as human as the horns.
Because there's no breath in it?
Maybe that's what it is. I guess that's what it is. But it just doesn't have the same. Even piano players get a more human feeling from their instruments. You know, you take someone like a monk who just, you know, that every time you hear, monk could play one note and you would know it was him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they get such a good feeling from the instrument. But guitar, and especially jazz guitar, when I started playing back in the early 60s, it all sounded exactly the same. The other night I heard a guitar player, and I realized that when a guitar player plays chords, and you'll see these guys with these magnificent hands, and they play chords that go 10 frets and things, you know, all these crazy things they do, and it all sounds like it could fit on a postage stamp. Guitar is exactly the same from the top of the guitar to the bottom of the guitar, you know, when you do it like that. And that's why I'm not so crazy about it. It just doesn't have the scope of other instruments, you know.
Is this to say that if you could, you would change your instrument tomorrow?
No, I don't have to because I'm already a tenor player. Lots of guys laugh. I know Farrell Sanders always cracks up when I tell him that, but it's true. I never have looked at myself as a guitarist.
Sonny Chirac, he died Thursday of a heart attack at the age of 53. We lost another great guitarist last week, Joe Pass. He died May 23rd of liver cancer at the age of 65. The many people he played with included Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, Frank Sinatra, Oscar Peterson, and Herb Ellis. Unfortunately, we have no interview to remember Pass with, but we close our show today with music from his album, Virtuoso. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Dorothy Farabee, with Nancy Greenlease and Jewel Bracey. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Henry Louis Gates, chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. In his new memoir, Colored People, Gates tries to evoke a colored world of the 50s, a Negro world of the early 60s, and the advent of a black world in the later 60s. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.